Have you ever wondered what happened to legendary Chuck Norris? He's in his 80s and still is kicking butt and working out and staying active. What's even more shocking is he's stronger, can work out longer, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife even started doing this one thing too, and she's never felt better. She says she feels 10 years younger, her body looks leaner, and she has energy all day. Chuck's made a 20-minute video explaining step by step how anyone can do the same thing to see incredible changes in their health. Go to mymorningkick.com/SOG and watch Chuck's video right now. Again, that's mymorningkick.com/SOG.
Tracy, over to you for weather.
The sun must be shining, Dave, because the 7 for 7 sale is back at Meijer. Mix or match hundreds of items like extra large avocados and mangoes, Kraft macaroni and cheese, and Glass O vitamin water. Pick any 7 for just $7. There's a strong chance of saving with the same quality Meijer deals in store or online. Back to you, Dave.
Sounds great, Tracy.
Deals so good. You've just got to talk about them. Meijer. Exclusions apply. See all the deals in the Meijer app.
Good morning, welcome to SOGcast number 19. Today we're joined by a fellow SOG veteran. We've been friends for over 52 years, and we've had different stories from SOG, but this one is, like all the others, truly unique in nature and from time on the ground. We want to thank Jocko Willink Productions for making this production possible today, and we just thank him and Echo Charles and our staff for getting this online and getting our stories out to the rest of the country. Today, we're joined by Doug Godshaw. Doug, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Tilt. How are you?
Good morning. Good. And we first met when you came back from Miloc. At some point, you came down to Fubai, I believe. And I remember we have a picture of you and me at the Camp Eagle launch site with Tony Harrell many months later. But you had your stories are so unique. I'd like to start off, if you don't mind, with because you're one of our unique survivors from August 23rd, the day the sapper attack was on FOB 4 in Da Nang, and we lost our 16 Green Berets that day, which is still the total worst tragic loss for Special Forces in our 60-year history. But you were there for that?
Yes,
and,
sir.
So at the time, just to bring our readers up to speed, in August the 22nd, they had a promotion board. They also had a the monthly meeting of the all the different.
The commander's conference was on August 22nd,
right.
And our commander at Miloc was there, and then I stayed over. The so-called promotion board was to be the 23rd of August.
Right, and so the commander, at that time we had 6 FOBs, so each commander was there.
Correct.
And then Clyde Sincere was representing FOB3, which was at Miloc at that time.
Correct.
And so you come down for the promotion board, and you had a couple drinks that night?
Yes. I joined up with my friend John Peters and my friend Bill Brick. Bill and I had come to Vietnam together from training group. We had a really interesting short tour of training group, as you know.
Indeed.
And Bill was stationed at FOB 4, so he had a hooch. So John and I stayed in the hooch. And John and I took the advantage for the first time of probably of having a cocktail in Vietnam, and we went to the club and had a couple of drinks.
So after a couple of drinks, then at some point you and John retreated back to your hooch.
Correct.
And the weapons, your weapons had been secured like John's was secured?
We were very safe. We were doing everything correctly. We each had a .45. And we locked it up in Bill Brick's locker with Bill Brick's lock, so we were completely SOP with safety of weapons since we knew we were going to have a drink, and so there we were.
All right, so then, do you remember, what is your time frame for when you were really awakened by explosives?
It's something like 1:30 or 2 in the morning. People differ on it, but it certainly was O dark 30.
Indeed.
And Bill Brick was stationed there, so he grabbed his web gear and his piece, and he took off for the perimeter where he had a post. And John Peters and I were sitting there without a weapon because we'd locked up our 45s in the foot locker. I looked outside, and for the first time, I saw a bad guy very little clothes on, with a headband on, with a satchel of explosives, and they were throwing the explosives around. We know now that most of the guys who passed that night died very early. They either died in the first round of throwing the satchels or the first round of going into the hooches. So I was very lucky because they didn't come into my hooch, and I watched them go by, and then we had to decide what the next plan of action was going to be. So I met up with a young blonde lieutenant whose name I cannot recall, and he and I, and later Spider Parks, went around. We managed to find some weapons. And
could
we
have
went.
Been No Neck, Lieutenant Dahl?
It could have been. Very competent, very nice. We were very careful. We'd go to hooches, go around the corner, take a peek, look, see what we had. We had some weapons by that and helped suppress the sappers and the other people that came in there.
Wow.
And it was my first time that I ever get shot at.
Welcome to the war, huh?
Correct.
My God. So where'd you wind up? Somewhere as like one of the static positions? So you were like reconning with that lieutenant?
We were doing with the lieutenant and later with Spider. Spider says, hey, you got to talk more about what you did, Doug, because I was with you and we, you know, were just suppressing the enemy. And then the last piece, and remember that it wasn't just 16 KIAs. There was an additional 50 Purple Hearts. We had 66 SF guys or people at that camp wounded or killed.
I mean, oh, I forgot that number.
It was
is that right?
Yeah, it was terrible. And,
oh, yeah.
And we don't want to forget our Indige. Because the claim is that the bad guys came in and put a machine gun in the Indige barracks. We don't know how many Indige were killed. I mean, it was bloody. So as dawn broke, the last two sappers were in the shitter. And they left for heaven after being in the shitter for a while. So those were the last two guys. After that, I'm a little unclear. I know I'm back on a helicopter to Mylock. I knew Bill Brick had been killed. I think he was killed pretty quickly right after the sappers came in. I think he took a burst pretty early. And as you know, we've been pretty close to Steve over these years, his brother.
Yeah, and that's been one of the unique aspects of our relationship with the family.
Right, right.
We met Steve, 15 years ago maybe?
It's 20? Been a while. He's been a couple of SOAs. You and I visited his house. He's joined your chapter for many meetings in Southern California. And we're sitting here at the third group, MACV-SAG Memorial Week, and Kathy and I went to the USASOC Memorial and took a picture of Bill Brick's name and some other pictures and sent it on to Steve.
Absolutely. All 16 names are there.
Yes, they are. 16, then right after that, Stan Seating.
Right. Yeah, because I was out here for another event earlier this year and went down there. Sometimes you just stop at that wall and you see these names.
Yeah, right. There's over 1,000 names there.
Oh, yeah. Is that many?
Yeah.
And
starting with Korea.
Sure. And then we talk about our guys, and you just start reading the name. We forget. Well, you and I don't forget, but I mean, the deadly toll of people that we lost.
Yep.
During that Secret War, which is the 8-year Secret War. And, you brushed over this quickly, but your unique way of getting into SF, if you could go back to talk a little bit about that, how after you went through basic AIT, you're a special forces training group.
Correct.
And at some point they come out and say, hey, you guys wearing glasses, you don't qualify. And they took you out of the training. And where'd you go from there? Because this is one of these unique special forces stories.
Well, I read an article a couple years ago that I really liked. And it said, you know, special forces guys, when we started out in the 60s, were unusual. We weren't like Rangers. We weren't like SEALs. We were smart. And I know that Jocko is going to just absolutely come over the top. But we thought outside the box, and they said we had different guys in there. And they talked about it. Said, we have guys with glasses. Rangers and SEALs don't have any guys with glasses.
Yes.
So, Bill Brick and I and Mike Morehouse were all at training group. We'd started training group in those brand-new barracks, as we talked about.
Right.
It was my second time at Bragg. I'd done basic here. And a medic from the dispensary calls me down and says, Private, you have glasses. I says, yes, sir. I said something else, but I've had glasses since fourth grade. He says, well, how could you, you know, run missions behind enemy lines if you have glasses? I said, I have a spare, and I'm not that damn blind. Anyway, we were thrown out for having glasses. In today's special forces, they'll operate you on your eyes to improve your vision.
Really?
Yeah.
I want to sign up. I could use some help.
Yeah, exactly. No, that, I read that about 15 years ago. If you qualify and you make it through the selection process, and they'll do an operation on your eyes.
Oh,
anyway,
God.
So we still all wanted to go to Vietnam. We went through Oakland, Bill Brick and Mike Morehouse and I, and wound up in Benoit. And we're sitting there in that stifling heat, and a first lieutenant, Green Beret, comes up and talks to us and says, do you guys still want to be in Special Forces? We said, hell yes. So we got orders to go to Nha Trang, the headquarters of the 5th Group, and went something called the COC course, Command Orientation Course. Only the Army could call it the COC course.
Indeed. Is that what the title was in 68?
Yeah, COC. Okay. And it was a three-week course, and most of the guys went to SOG. Bill Badger, an infamous member of RT Louisiana.
Oh, and Dave Badger.
Dave Badger, yeah. an infamous person. But other people, and we went to SOG. So I went to Fubai first, had a cup of coffee with a hatchet force there, and then went to My Lock. So I came in country July 10, and I'm in the Trang like July 12, 13, 14, 15.
Yeah.
3 weeks. So the beginning of August, go to Fubai, and then to My Lock, which was my PCS with Major Sincere, my first combat commander. And then it was from there that we went to Da Nang for the infamous stupid promotion board. I remember talking to Roy Barr at SOAR a couple years ago, the late Roy Barr, the great Roy Barr.
Indeed.
And I said, you got to tell me, sir, what was the purpose of that promotion board? And he said, it was pretty damn stupid. I mean, there's no reason to have it. You know, if you were in the upper ranks trying to get it promoted to E7 or E8, that's something. But PFC to Spec 4, I mean, that's a rubber stamp, okay?
Oh, yeah. I never appeared before a promotion
exactly.
board.
Exactly. I never appeared for one my entire time in the Army.
Yeah.
I was supposed to, but I didn't. So anyway, that was the promotion board story. As you know, we were honored 3 years ago at SOAR to present to the families of those who had fallen on 2368, a very nice program. Which were helped by Bonnie Cooper and Eldon Bargewell and Spider Parks were honorary co-chairmen.
And you put aside your modesty for a moment. This was the Special Operations Association, of which you are now duly elected president, sir.
Until impeached, yes, sir.
Until impeached. Indeed. But, you know, we got to back up a little bit, talk about your FOB-3, because earlier in 68, FOB-3 was located at Quezon.
Correct.
As on the western perimeter, I believe, of the historic Quezon battle with the Marine Corps.
I believe it was the West Wall, yes.
And so they were running missions out of there. When Quezon was closed, we still needed that operational base up there. Clyde Sincere went out and opened My Lock, which had no perimeter. And when you got there, what was it like besides muddy?
It was just mud. There's one picture of me with a tent with no shirt on, and I'm having a cigarette, and I remember going into whatever the closest ville was and buying a bamboo mat, okay, because that's what I slept on.
Really?
Yeah. We had a cook who was, I don't know what his English was like, but we had a cook, and that's the only staff person I think we had was a cook.
Oh, my.
Why they picked that place, I don't know. Because, as you know, right next door, they were building an A-team. There was an SFA team at My Lock that they were building, you know, structures for. We didn't get shit. Okay, there was just nothing there. Why they put it there, I don't know. It was a short chopper ride from Quezon. That's all I can say. It's still close to Route 9 and the DMZ and Laos. So.
And the targets across the fence.
Yes, exactly.
So indeed.
It was a launch site, really. I mean, it really wasn't FOB. It was just a place for helicopters to land.
Well, yeah, and they started to do that perimeter, and that was when they had one of those tragedies when they were putting mines out, that we lost one of our soldiers there with a bouncing Betty.
Yeah, we lost Gary Mattson, and you know, there's Jeff Junkins was with him, and that kind of messed him up too for the rest of his life.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, that was horrible. I wasn't there that day, But, you know, I came back and they said, be very careful. I think Junkins was trapped in the minefield for a couple of hours.
He landed on top of one.
Yeah.
And then the team members came out and were able to get him off it without being exploded.
Right.
I just can't imagine.
Well, it was a dangerous place. If you wanted to get out to Route 9, it wasn't that far. It was a couple of miles. But you had to take minesweepers out, hand minesweepers, and go ahead of the deuce and a half to get to Route 9 to get there. It was primitive.
Indeed. And Route 9 was one of the major
highways.
That was, right. Yes, indeed.
Paralleling the DMZ.
And there was that... so while you're at Mylock, at some point you run into another Spec 4.
I ran into four interesting people, including you. but I ran into a guy named Eldon Bargewell. He came out a little later than I did. I ran a mission with Recon Team Georgia, Tom Cofield and Stan Seeding the day after I got back from 23 August 68.
Really? Right away?
Right away, yeah. And we went into...
That was your cherry mission.
That was my cherry mission. We went to an AO in Laos, which I learned later no one had lasted a day. We lasted 5 days. All we heard was warning shots. And then, you know, I'm the low man on the totem pole.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
carrying the PRIC-25. I'm the 1-2. And we were in our RON position waiting to be extracted on the fifth day. We had IFR weather. The weather was terrible. Well, we got overrun. This is the second time in a week I got overrun. I was overrun Godshall. Don't hang out with me. Bad thing happened. We an estimated reinforced platoon came up on a hill. We had an Arvin sergeant there. We think we fell asleep. Tom Cofield beat himself up for the rest of his tour of Vietnam. And we suffered some horrendous casualties. Stan Seeding was killed. We had and the Arvin sergeant was killed. A bunch of us were wounded. And the helicopters, this is another story. SOA is just not recon teams.
Right.
MACV SOG is just not recon teams. It's helicopters.
Absolutely. We're all alive today thanks to them.
Right. Well, they navigated to our position in Laos by hitting their skids on the top of the trees. It was two slicks, no gunships, no Cobras, no A1Es, no cover whatsoever to come and get us. And we had to...
And you're under fire.
We're under fire, and I'm dragging Stan, and we're trying to get the rest of the team there. And they came there, and the world-famous chase medic, Dickie, was on the helicopter.
That's Dickie Crawford.
Dickie Crawford, yes. And I kept telling him, take care of Stan. Stan had been shot right away, and he was dead. I knew it, but Dickie kept telling me, don't worry about it. There's nothing you can do.
Wow.
So we flew to Quang Tri because we had some injured brew. Kumba had a hole in his shoulder you could see through, so we went to the Army Hospital in Quang Tri, and they wouldn't treat him because he was indigenous. So we convinced the staff that they really ought to treat them.
Or die.
We locked and loaded and said, we need to take care of this guy. So they did.
Oh, my God.
Then we came back to came back to Mylock, and I discovered then that I had some shrapnel in my shoulder and arm. And Robert Shippen... Medic extraordinaire.
Medic, sure.
He took some shrapnel out of various pieces of my shoulder and left arm and wrapped me up in a bandage. I looked like, he looked like he took all the bandages he had and wrapped me up. It looked like 10 pounds of bandages. And Roy Barr flew in from Fubai because he'd heard about, you know, we'd had this disaster. And he said, how are you? I said, sir, I'm just fine. There's nothing here. And Shippen says, no, this is a real... I said, we're okay. Okay?
Yeah.
We're just fine. The forward story is I refused to take a Purple Heart.
Right.
And actually, my dad did the same thing in World War II in the Navy.
When he is that right?
250 people on his ship killed. He said, I'm not taking a Purple Heart.
Oh, my God.
And he died with shrapnel in his chest. So about 6 months later, I'm in Da Nang with Dickie and... There's some very nice people nominated me for a Silver Star. They gave it to Stan Seeding, which is the right thing to do for his family. We lost him. And I'm in Da Nang with Dickie walking up the main drag, and he said, you didn't take a Purple Heart. I said, sir, you know, Stan was killed. The Arvin guy was killed. Kumba had a hole through him. I just had some shrapnel. And he said, one of these days, and I can't tell you the whole story, but one of these days, you're so ugly, but you might find some woman who likes you. You might figure out how to make children, and your children should know that you were wounded. So my Purple Heart says Sergeant Godshall because it was given 6 months later.
Right,
and
by that time you've been promoted.
Without a promotion board.
Right, and with glasses.
And with glasses. And I had those ugly gray glasses they gave.
Oh, they were a stone. You and Tony had those ugly glasses.
Eldon Bargewell said those were the biggest prophylactics the Army could have. No one was going to want to date anyone with those stupid glasses. And then fast forward many, many years.
Yeah.
Eldon Bargewell found me because we both were on the same Purple Heart orders. He got his first Purple Heart on the same orders I got my only Purple Heart. In April of 68, and so forth. Well, back to Eldon, everyone's favorite E4. He showed up in Mylock, spent a cup of coffee there, because he was only there. We were there in August, and it was shut down in December. I mean, it wasn't even a year that it was there. And then I got to know him better in Da Nang when he was running teams. He was running RT Michigan. I was a strap hanger all the time. RT Georgia didn't have a 1-0 for a long time. And I ran a couple of missions with him. He was a tremendous athlete. I mean, really a good athlete.
Oh,
he was
yeah.
a star halfback in high school. I think he played football in college, and he could run like a deer. And he never forgot anything. If you told him something, he never forgot it. He had a fantastic memory. And
sometimes that was really a liability.
It was. But he's also a little superstitious, as a since we all were. You know?
Oh, yeah,
and he
absolutely.
Said, here's my issue. He says, if I take your picture, you live. Everyone who I take your picture of, they survive. I said, take my picture. So there's a bad picture that Jason Hardy has of me standing, looking. I'm 21, I look like I'm 9, standing in the recon company with a stupid hat on, a stupid smile, and those stupid gray glasses.
Oh, my God.
And Jason Hardy found that for me years ago. But I ran a couple missions with Eldon, and, you know, he was the legendary SOG soldier for most of us. And when he finally called me up in late August, when SOAR was still in September, and he said, is this Doug Godshall? And I'm thinking, you know, what's this guy trying to sell me? Was this Doug Godshall in Special Forces of Vietnam? I said, yes, sir. He said, this is Eldon. I said, Eldon, how are you? He says, you got to come out to SOA. I said, what's SOA? And I had just won tickets to the Ryder Cup in a lottery. It was in Kentucky. And I gave the tickets to a client of mine, a friend of mine, to go, and I came out to SOA, and Cleet was the president.
Yeah.
And he said, welcome home. And Eldon couldn't have been nicer to me. Got to see you.
And Eldon was on the board then, too, as a director, I think.
I think he was.
Yeah.
Troll came up to me. Everyone remembers Troll, George Sternberg.
Indeed. Sogcast number one.
Exactly. Was he?
Yeah.
He should be.
Yeah.
And he said, you ran with Eldon, didn't you? I said, yeah. He says, welcome home. And so,
no kidding.
Yeah. It was very interesting. And I met Robert Shippen, you know, who had stitched me up.
Indeed.
And then so when I brought my wife out a year or two later to the next SOAR, Shippen ratted on me. He told Kathy that I had to be escorted to my room because I had probably been overserved. Kathy said, you stinker. Anyway, no. I said, Shippen, you're the stinker. You know,
indeed.
You're ratting on your buddy here.
Indeed. There's some things that should stay in my life.
Exactly. Stay away from me. But he's a good guy.
So when you ran a couple of those targets with Eldon, he was the 1-0 at that point?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. So you learned from the master.
Yeah.
And Tom Cofield was a good 1-0.
Tom Cofield was
great
a
guy.
Good 1-0. There was a guy named Andy, whose name I can't remember. We went to a mission in the DMZ with Andy. He was a good guy. As I said, I was a strap hanger. After we lost Steeding, we had incomplete team. I went TDY to Bambi Tuitt for a month, ran with a guy named Gregory Grandison, a 1-0 there.
So they picked you up and sent you there by yourself without a team or anything?
Correct.
Oh, my God.
Right. And I was talking to Captain Harrison, who's here today.
Randy Harrison?
Randy Harrison.
Yes.
Yeah, he was the recon company commander. And I'm trying to remember the name of the other guy I ran with. I'm still a 1-2. Ran a mission with a Grandison, who was a good guy, another blonde-haired officer, into Cambodia. It was so flat. It was lovely. Compared to Laos, you know, you just no up and down. It's great on your knees. Then he got sick after the first mission, which was, I think it's the only mission I was on that we never got shot at. We were set for another mission, and this E5, who was the 1-1, ran the team. So we got inserted near the, quote, Big River in Cambodia. We're not supposed to name it the Big River. You know, it was the Mekong.
Indeed.
And doing a river watch, and we were on this little island, and I didn't know it then, but this E5 had never been out before. That was his Cherry Run, and he's the team commander now.
Oh, wow. Because he was there and you weren't. You're a strap hanger, even though you got worlds of experience.
That's all right.
Yeah.
So we see this boat out in the middle of the river, and it's got a big damn gun on it. It's about a 30-foot boat, patrol boat, and it's got like the equivalent of a 50 caliber on it. And it's going the opposite way from we came in. We came on the waist of this island. There was a little path. It wasn't that far from the mainland, maybe 100 yards. And I said to this guy, I said, if that boat turns around, they found us. Okay. It's only been about an hour since we infiltrated, since we landed.
Yeah.
And we make a lot of noise. You know, people say, how do they find you? Well, the helicopters make a shitload of noise.
Always. Okay.
And sure enough, the boat turned around, starts heading toward our island. And so I turned to my team leader, and I said, okay, what are we going to do? And he's sitting under the tree shaking.
Oh, no.
He completely flipped out. He couldn't handle it. So I took over the team. I split the team against all the rules.
Indeed.
Put my best mountaineers out on the point where the boat was coming with some claymores. And I thought they'd also attack us from the land on the waist, and I got lucky. So I took that piece there. I took some soldiers there. And we were very lucky, got all my guys out. They landed at two places, and none of my guys suffered a scratch.
Wow.
And
so the claymores worked on the boat?
The claymores worked on the guys getting off the boat. We worked on the other side with the car 15s and the grenades. And then so we're waiting now. I called for a prairie fire for an extract. And Curly got on the phone. The commander of Bammy Tuit, who is a well-beloved guy who was follically challenged. And he said, whoever this is, I want you to continue the mission, Charlie Mike. I said, sir, with all due respect, I cannot. I didn't tell him my team leader was paralyzed and useless and still sitting by a tree chattering. And so he came back to Bammy Tuit. I just told the colonel, never send this guy out again. That's all I got to say. Don't happen. Don't do that. And we are also, in addition to River Watch, we were supposed to do in a snatch. He wanted to, you know, everyone always wanted a POW
always.
Snatch. Always. So he made fun of me at dinner at the mess hall last night. You know, Godshall came back, and he didn't get a prisoner, and we're going to get one next time, in a good-natured way.
Yeah, of course. Curly.
Curly made me stand up and say, here's another failure. He didn't get a POW. But I ran two missions at Bammy too. It was a nice place.
Wow. Yeah, because I never got there. I was just down at Honuktel, which is FOB-6. And still, so the idea was they're just going to put you on the island, you're going to watch the river, and you're only out there for an hour, and your cover's broken, and here they come with a 50 caliber.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I'm looking at this guy, I say, oh, my God, what are you doing there? You know? Anyway. So.
Just another day in
SOG. I was lucky. I was a lucky guy.
So from there, you go back. At some point, you wind up at Fubai. Then they close Fubai?
I think I went directly from Bammy Tuit to Da Nang. It was around Thanksgiving, Christmas, and my lot closed at some point. I wasn't there when the infamous mission with the crummy ammunition went into Laos.
November 30th.
Yeah. I was not there then, so
right.
I know I had Thanksgiving.
Well, that's one of those little moments in time. We were talking about that at the last reunion.
Right.
You're down at FOB-5, is at FOB-6, and we all came home after that Kingby crash got shot down.
Right.
With 7SF on it, and then they were later able to recover them. And they were also, I think, is that the one where they also buried the Kingby crew with the Americans?
I'm not sure about that. I know that when we were burying the successor to our team, Michigan, in Arlington 10 years ago or whatever it was, Billy Brown and Gunther Wald and Shu, that Eldon took us of a tour of Arlington, and there's a memorial to those guys. In Arlington, the memorial to those guys on the Divide who died on November 30th, 1968, when they were shot down, shot up, whatever.
Yeah.
But there was one, I think, Air Force guy whose family never believed that, their son was killed because they couldn't get his remains or remains satisfactory. It's very sad. But there is a memorial to them.
Right.
In
and just for our listeners, on November 30th, we had an H-34 South Vietnamese Air Force Kingby that was flying towards Laos, or maybe actually over Laos at the time,
could
had gone
been.
Across a fence. And the mission was an Elder Sun,
correct.
Which was to insert ammunition that was rigged to explode
right.
when the enemy used it. And so it was a volunteer mission, and with seven SF men on it, and that might be Rob Graham. And then en route, they get shot down, and
right.
we had the muskets were flying escort, and Berg Garlow was one of the witnesses that saw it get hit and go down.
Yeah.
And they came back, and in our case, we were literally in the field, and they pulled us out and said, you got to get back to FOB-1. And that was why. And so I'm assuming you went right back, too, because of the same reason.
I don't know what, Ray, but I'm pretty sure I went from Bami to it directly to
sure.
Da Nang and spent the rest of the 69 until I went home in Da Nang.
And so when you land at Da Nang, you're a strap hanger?
I'm still with RT Georgia. I had a bunch
back on Georgia. Okay.
They were always trying to find a 1-0 for Georgia, and they had a couple of candidates that didn't work out, and but I would do strap hanging in between. I wanted to be active. There was always a couple of guys who were giving me a hard time because I didn't graduate from training group. And
You're there?
Oh, yeah. So I always said, I'm going to try to run as many missions as I can and just prove that I'm doing the job.
Indeed.
You know, period. So I did a lot of strap hanging. The last recon mission I ran was the infamous Dewey Canyon, which you know all about.
But tell our listeners a little bit about that, because that was a hellacious sideshow.
Well, from a command point of view, it was a total clusterfuck.
Indeed.
But, we were a battalion-sized operation, which SF never did, let alone MACV SOG, on the west side of the Ashau in Laos.
Yeah.
And as you know, the Ashau Valley was probably the most dangerous area in South Vietnam. We had an A-team that the base had been wiped out years ago.
We had three A-teams wiped out. Yeah, yes, sir.
Horrible. So, and the Marines were on the east side. They were on the VN sort of the border, and we were sort of a blocking force and sort of try to push the bad guys towards the Marines where they can wipe them out. So there was Lieutenant Armstrong had one of the companies. He had a brew company. I forget who had the other company of Indige. I'm pretty sure Dan Thompson was on that mission too, but I could be wrong. But I know Mike Armstrong was. But
right.
I was running point. For the
you're running point.
I was running point, and we're on the top of a ridge, and if you're in a two company operation, you're always going to be in a fast trail. I mean, you can't go through the woods like we
right.
could on a 10-man, 9-man recon team. So I found at the top of the ridge a little cache of enemy supplies, maybe twice or three times the size of this desk. There was some rice, there was some combs, there was some uniforms. And the infamous Major Moore was the commander.
No.
And so we stopped and we called him up, and he said, well, I want you to destroy this cache, Sergeant Cottrell. I said, sir, that wouldn't be my choice. We make too much noise as it is. I'm used to being on recon teams. We don't talk for 5 days. We
yeah.
just talk about break and hand signals and all that. And he wants us to destroy this cache, which is going to make too much noise. And so
there'll be smoke, so anybody can sight in for
yeah,
artillery.
Why don't you just tell them where the hell we are?
Yeah.
Excuse me, sir. But anyway, I didn't say that. I'm sure I didn't. I wasn't that brave.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was my turn to be relieved from the point, and we know what happened after noon. The team that took over the point was another guy. I'm from Pennsylvania. He was from Pennsylvania, from Montgomery County, and took over the point, and about 150 yards walked into an L-shaped ambush and got wiped out.
Whoa.
And so instead of doing anything, we sat there. There was a Nung company. In addition to the brew company, there was a Chinese Nung company. We sat there for a few days, just sat there, and that enabled the bad guys to zero in their mortars. So at 7
sure.
a.m., at 7 a.m., here's the incoming. we dug in. They were very good. I mean, they hit within a foot of my of the hole I had dug once, and all the dirt spread out, no one got hurt. But after a few days, the engineer types got some C4 and blew some of the trees down to make an LZ so that we could get out of there. Somehow, they'd made a determination we weren't going to go forward. I don't know why. I would have rather gone forward, kept moving, And just, you know, keep moving, watch out. We had a large enough force that we could handle ourselves. So late one afternoon, the first helicopters come in. And later on, I got the story because I'm still, maybe I'm a sergeant then, I don't know, or spec four. But the first one who left the LZ was Major Moore. He was the commander. He got on the first chopper. They had a temporary LZ in Vietnam set up, and there was an 06 waiting there. Now, I don't know where this 06 was from. I don't know where it was from, Saigon, but he's waiting to, you know, greet us there. And we came in on big choppers, and Major Moore gets off, and the 06 supposedly said, "I've never been more shocked in my professional life to see the commander be the first one to step off the exfiltration."
Oh, my God.
I got out later that day. They didn't get us all out that night. The Nungs started walking away, and we got everyone out the next few days. And I saw Major Moore in Da Nang a few days later saying, "Well, see you later. I'm going back to the States." So he got relieved of any further duties in connection with the war and went home.
Because this was the same Major Moore that on August 22nd, he was told, and days before, to release three transmissions saying attack imminent.
We think so, but we're not sure.
Not 100% sure.
If you get on, I'm not much on Googling stuff, but there's pages of stuff on Dewey Canyon from people who were officers or commanders at that time, not me, who wrote information about Dewey Canyon, but... We think it's the same Major Moore, but we do not know that.
Yeah.
I do not know that.
Indeed. We can just deal with the facts here. Nothing right. But the facts, sir.
And then after that, I went to, I got to meet Mike Armstrong, wonderful, wonderful officer, wonderful man. And he asked me to be the first sergeant on the Hatchet Force, which is a big deal for being the only other American. He was the commander. He was a first lieutenant or a captain. I was a sergeant in the Ransom Hatch. I remember talking to the the senior NCOs, and they said, "Doug, you're still going to go out with missions." I said, "That's fine. I just want to go out with a guy I know who's a good leader." We did.
Somebody you trust.
Somebody I trust. The 10s that came through Georgia did not work out. One of them, this is one of my wife's favorite stories, was a young lieutenant, Cherry. And his father was a lifer, and this guy was gung-ho. So he's going to be the 10 for Georgia. We go down to Saigon, and we get briefed by a 2-star Air Force guy. Where are we going? Well, we're going to go to the northwest quadrant of the Mujia Pass, the main pass from North Vietnam to Laos and the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They had some pretty good high-resolution pictures. You could see 55-gallon drums.
Yeah.
On the ground. Well, what's in the southeast corner? Well, there's a battalion of troops. What's in the northeast corner? Well, there's a battalion of troops. Well, what's in the southwest corner? There's some troops there, too. What about the northwest corner? Well, we don't know. That's why you're sending us, why we're sending you there, Sergeant Lieutenant. And I said, "Well, have we had any teams go in there?" "Well, not any teams with Americans. We've had Indige go in with those radios that say punch for tank, punch for troops, and so forth."
Yeah, yeah.
"What'd they find?" "Well, they didn't come out." I said, "With all due respect, sir, I know who's in there. It's my buddies from the 5th NVA Panzer Division. That's who's in there. That place is full of bad guys, okay?" So,
how'd you know that?
Also, the indigenous teams and don't come out. Then, so we came back to Da Nang, and we're running a training mission with my new 10, and I talked to the Brew. They weren't going out with him. They weren't going to go out with a Cherry 10.
Right.
So we had a little training mission. Helicopter tipped a little bit, and he got pushed a little bit out of the helicopter, not from very high, but just from about 10 feet, just enough to break a leg or an ankle. And we did not go out with him.
Oh, my. These unfortunate accidents.
Unfortunate accident, yes. It was very unfortunate. I hope his orthopedic injuries went well.
Indeed. Well, so you're juggling Hatchet Force duty, and at that point, do you finally become the 10 for
Georgia? I was the 1-1 for months, you know, and I was very happy doing that.
Yeah.
I did not want to be a 10. I turned down Rokkando School. I just wanted to run missions and, you know, be a contributor to
just like that's like the Doug Eternals, same.
Just go. And
yeah.
That's it.
Oh, my God. So you wound up going in with the Hatchet Force with
yes.
Armstrong.
Yes.
What kind of missions were they? Because we never hear much about the Hatchet Force.
Yeah, well, they're more of an attack force when you're looking for something to attack them. I know that on the last mission, again, we're looking for POWs. You know, we're trying to make a snatch. So we're big enough that we could, deploy a squad or two to, use as a minor blocking force if we found a guy. We didn't. One of the most interesting things I ever did in Vietnam was in our last Hatchet Force mission. We were probably in South Vietnam, right on the border. But the Navy had a program. They wanted to use their battleships. And the USS New Jersey, was offshore. And I talked to a Lieutenant Fack from the Navy, and we called in firepower, 16-inch rounds, from the New Jersey. It was the stupidest thing. Why were we called 16-inch rounds into the triple canopy jungle? What was the point of that, We had to walk them in from a click away. We had to start away from a click.
Oh, sure.
And, we were never sure where the fuck we were anyway and on the ground. So we walked it in, and I called in, firepower from the New Jersey in May or June of 1969. But
I can't imagine that firepower. So did it ignite at the top of the triple canopy, or did it penetrate through?
No, it went through. It penetrated through. It made a big sound.
Oh, yeah. I can remember hearing them go overhead. It sounded like a Volkswagen going over your head.
And they also, when they fired those off, those big cannons, and by the way, the New Jersey's in Camden, New Jersey now. It's a permanent part of your native state, my grandfather's native state. And when they fired those guns, they fired blanks on the other side so that the ship didn't tip. So
that's a little factoid I never knew.
Yeah. So MACV-SOG was helped by the Navy that day.
Indeed. Did you actually have any enemy to shoot at, or were you just firing for effect?
I have no idea. My recollection is very poor on that, but I know we probably had some guys, we had some bad guys we were trying to fire up, but I would have chosen other ways to do it.
Well, there aren't many SOG guys that can say, I called in the USS New Jersey on a 16-inch rounds. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Because they're like 2,000 pounds.
Yeah, they were big suckers. Yeah, they're a little bigger than the NATO round, just a little.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, you got this Navy background. That's fascinating. You got those details. I never knew that, because they fired, then they fired blanks on the other side to keep a balance on the ship. Otherwise,
correct,
it would have rolled over.
It would have rolled. I think it rolled over. But those are some big explosions when those suckers leave the cannon.
So you and Armstrong did a couple of missions with the Hatchet Force?
Yeah, we did two or three, something like that, because I got on the Hatchet Force like February, March, and my DeRos was in July. Great guy, wonderful man.
And in between, you come back to do anything more with RT Georgia?
No, I passed them on. I said, we got to get we got to get the team up to strength with Americans. You need a qualified 1-0. And they continued on. I know they did missions in 70 and 71. RT Georgia was still around.
Sure, I remember them in camp after that mission when Tom was the 1-0 that you were on.
Right.
And there was that question. At one point we had, do you remember Henry King?
Yes.
And Henry was from Georgia. We kept saying, Henry, this is perfect. You're from Georgia.
Right.
You should be the 1-0. And he was like, no, I don't want 1-0 duty.
Right.
And no, then
neither did I.
Yeah, so when he said no, we took him out on a mission with us, and he took the experimental pump M79, and he took that, but he carried all this ammo, and the second day we're on the ground, we climbed this mountain all day, and we got near the top, Henry goes, can I get rid, bury a couple of rounds? Because he was beat, but he was strong.
He's a big guy.
Oh, yeah.
He's a big, strong guy.
Great guy.
Yeah.
And he ran, like you, he ran many teams, other teams than us, as a strap hanger.
Yeah.
But that's doesn't decrease the danger at all.
No, there's a piece of strap hanging that's not smart because you've not worked with the team and you're not sure what the guy is going to do under fire. But I'd been on a number of teams and a number of missions, so I was considered reliable. I wasn't going to
screw up too much. Right, you had a good reputation. And the little people talk behind the scenes because
they
would go, who's this guy? And they would go to the team that you had been on or been out with. So your reputation was rock solid there.
Well, that's why we had that issue with the new 1-0, and we talked to the brew that we weren't going out with him. So we came up with a plan.
So of all your targets with Georgia, what was your worst mission? Which one comes to mind?
Well, I think the worst mission has got to be the first one.
One with Tom.
Yeah, the one with Tom and Stan Seeding. I mean, Stan was killed right away. It was horrible. We didn't expect it. Run over. I just come back from 23 August, and that was just horrible.
Sure.
Sure. I mean, there were bloodier missions, there were more casualties on other missions, but Stan and Tom had treated me so well. So.
Indeed. So at some point, you turn around, you come home?
I did. I didn't know what I was getting into in July of 68, but by July of 69, I was treated very well.
Yeah.
And when I left, they said, we'd like to give you your S designation on the MOS. I turned that down because I still had an attitude. You know,
yeah.
Fuck you. You didn't want to give it to me. You threw me out of the training group. I ran missions here. They asked me to go to OCS, and I turned that down. And years later, when I talked to Eldon, because I had seen him once or twice in Bragg in my last year.
Right.
And he said, you turned down an S designation? I said, yes. He said, that was a stupid fucking thing to do. I said, yes, it was, Eldon. It was stupid. That was a mistake on my part.
So he live
got,
and learn.
He and Cliff Newman got me orders later on. There's a lot of guys early in the history of SF that didn't go through his training group.
Right.
The Bad Tolls group.
Sure.
And Cliff Newman was one of them. Clyde Sincere is another one. He said, you're qualified. I'll get you orders so that you can get the Special Forces tab in lieu of the fact that you were such a dumbass and didn't get the S. So.
Well, you're busy running missions, too. It wasn't like you were sitting around playing tiddlywinks.
Right. Anyway, but it was very nice. And Cliff and Eldon took care of me, and I got those very nice orders.
Well, yeah. And the one of the sidebars to that is the missions were so difficult. We lost so many people.
We did.
That by 68, we were recruiting from other airborne units. Like, we had a guy that came over from the 173rd, ran a mission with us, Mike Krawchak. Came in from the 101st.
Lou DeSeda.
Lou DeSeda from the 173rd?
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's why Mike and I and Bill were recruited also. We were 11 Bravos. We'd gone through infantry training. As you know, you didn't have to have infantry training to be in training group. But
right.
If you had infantry training,
it helped.
It were helped. And we'd been through jump school, so Clyde and I had conversations later, many years later, and he said, yeah, I was always looking for people. We lost 68, you know, SOG average, 2 wounds apiece. All of us averaged 2 wounds. I had one.
Oh, is that right?
From, Georgia, and then I had one from friendly fire doing a mission with one of these trainee 10s who fired an M79 in front of me on a training mission, and I had shrapnel in my right arm this time.
Now you're balanced.
Well, the worst injury is I hit him on the side of my head with the M79. Stupid asshole, don't do that. And I got to meet John Walton.
Is that right?
John Walton took the shrapnel out of my right leg. Well, my right arm.
Yeah.
John Walton, the legendary medic, Silver Star.
Indeed.
Handsomest guy in Da Nang, and he died with a couple of pennies in his pocket. Sam Walton's.
Indeed,
Sam Walton's
he did.
What a great guy.
Absolutely. One of our best all-time medics.
Yep. Yep.
And brought back Tom Cunningham after his leg was blown off August 3rd in Ashaw.
Yep.
Oh, my God. Yeah, so because we had Bob Shipman also help later with the Frenchman get his Purple Heart.
Yep.
Because his first mission, he had shrapnel, and it took us 40 years plus to get the – but Bob Shipman and Colonel Barr.
And Colonel Barr, yeah.
They both stepped up to the plate.
Right.
And we got Doug his Purple Heart. So it's like these medics of fame.
Right.
Indeed. So so you go back to Bragg. You begin to wrap things up there. How long were you there at Bragg? You go into 7th group then or 3rd?
No, I told you, I turned down my S, and one of the reasons I did is I wanted to go to Fort Lewis to become a drill sergeant.
Okay.
They had openings there, and I thought I could help some of these 19-year-old idiots going into the first air cab. Survive for a month. So I got back to Bragg, and they said, no, you're going to the division because you're still P-qualified. So I spent an unhappy year in the division hiding from all my SF friends. I should have written back to Da Nang and said, give me my S, I would have gone to one of the groups. working for sergeant as a personnel NCO, filling out morning reports and
right.
waiting to get out, and got out in August 70 and went back to Philly.
Back to Philadelphia.
Yep.
So where'd you go from there?
I went and started school back the next day. I had screwed up college the first time.
See, another parallel. I flunked out. Did you flunk out or did you just quit?
I did not flunk out. I quit.
I was kicked out.
Absolutely, yeah. So when we were doing burying RT Michigan in Arlington, we're burying Boyer.
Boyer.
And his sister said, you know, my brother started college and it didn't work and he joined Special Forces. And I said to her, there's lots of us like that.
Absolutely.
I bet everyone, 90% had been to college and decided it wasn't working for whatever.
John Walton was one of us.
Yes, right.
But the school, he got bored. Unlike me flunking out and you got bored of it and said, I'm going to go to war now.
Yeah.
And you signed up.
Yeah.
Did you read the book?
Oh, yeah.
Ah, see?
My mother gave me Robin Moore's book, The Green Beret, on Christmas of 1964, my senior year in high school. And that's what got me. I mean,
Oh, me too.
I wanted to do that, yeah.
Yeah, because the summer of 66, I'm working in Yosemite. Dad goes, hey, you did it, you're out. The board's going to come draft you. And literally within days, I saw the book, and I was a trash man, garbage man. And during the break, I read the book. It's like, that's it. If I'm going to Nam, I want to go with these guys.
Exactly, exactly.
Because, you know, I had that story about the guy who was killed in Vietnam, SF guy. He says, if I get killed, name a latrine after me. And when we went to Nha Trang, I found a latrine and used his latrine because I read about it in the book.
Right.
Yeah.
Little known story that probably deserves to remain little known.
Indeed, yeah. And so, okay, you go back, where'd you go to college?
I went back to Temple University in Philadelphia.
Great school.
And worked and went to school and just kept my head squared away and got a degree in, I did 90 credits in 21 months.
90 in 21 months?
Yeah, I was really embarrassed that I'd screwed up college the first time, so I wanted to do it correctly the second time. So.
Oh, my God. Law school?
I took a year off, drove a truck, went to Europe for a little bit, and then went to law school and met the lovely Kathy.
Indeed.
Yes.
And to law school where?
Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So I've been TDY in Ohio since 1973. One of these days I'm going to PCS to Eastern Pennsylvania.
Oh, things to work on, right? Projects.
That's right.
And then, of course, we've talked a little bit about the Special Operations Association. Eldon recruited you in there.
He did.
And during these last few years, other than the COVID year, that we were all MIA because of COVID in 2020, but prior to that, you were on the board of directors.
You put me on. It's your fault.
No comment. But you're there. You helped us with a couple of major events, which are, you know, others that are familiar with the SOA said is truly unique. We had the 2018 reunion, which you were part of, and of course we had Bonnie Cooper working with us and a few others, Mike Taylor.
Saint Bonnie the Good.
Indeed. And so we had that 50th anniversary to remember and pay homage to the 16 men we lost on August 23rd.
Yes.
Some families came out, and that was, for all of us, that was just a big day.
We had, in the 300 people in the breakfast, we had 5 Medal of Honor winners.
Five?
Five.
I'd forgotten that.
And they never, you know, stood up and said, hey, I'm an MOH guy or anything like that. Those guys didn't roll like that. And,
right.
The families were overwhelmed. We also did a ceremony at the wall in D.C. on the exact 50th day, on 23 August 2018. Dan Thompson and I put together a ceremony and had most of the families there. Steve Rick was there with his family. And it's just so sad, you know. The survivor's guilt just grabs you with those things. Why am I standing here? Why wasn't I wiped out on the first the first hours, like Bill Brick was, you know. So it was a very. Well, I'm glad we did it. The families really enjoyed it. We went and let them know they are never forgotten. They never will be.
Yeah, because every time they have that at our reunion, we have that reading for the POW MIA table. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think Phil Devon, our current treasurer, he's a numbers guy. He did the math. When you talk about the missing soldiers from MACV-SOG, it's something like 15% of our number are still missing. We are missing something like, between the recon teams and the flight crews, about 150. The total missing from the Vietnam War is 1,500.
1,584.
We're 10% of that, and we had maybe 300 guys running recon teams at any one point.
Right.
Maybe.
Yeah. And they, because the numbers break down, it's like 20,000 SF during the entire war. 2,000 were in SOG, and out of 2,000, depending on which author you talk to,
yes,
500 to 700 or 800 ran missions across the fence.
Maybe.
Yeah. I know each author, like Plaster has one number, I've got one, but mine always bounced around from talking to others and talking to our friends at DPAA.
Right, right. I was talking to Dave Maurer the other 19.
Yeah, and Dave, just for the record, is one of those unique gentlemen who, like Cleet Sinyard, was in the Battle of the Idrang Valley first with 1st Cav before he came to Special Forces.
He had 900 days in Vietnam.
900?
900. And he was an outstanding 1-0 with RT Louisiana.
Sure.
With that idiot Badger. And so he and I were chatting, and he said, and he wrote, in my opinion, the outstanding novel. You've written some great nonfiction, so it's John
Plaster. Oh, The Dying Place is classic.
The Dying Place is just classic. My
Absolutely.
Wife's read it. She loves the book. And so he said, you ran some missions with Eldon. How many missions did you do? I said, I didn't do that many. I said, maybe 10, maybe 15, something like that. And he says, he starts laughing. He said, the average guy did 2 to 3. And he says, by the way, you're the only guy I know who's not a sergeant major or 100% disabled. Everyone else was a sergeant major. I said, I was never a sergeant major.
So right.
Okay, let's throw that one out.
I was a shrapnel connector, like Tilt.
That's right. Yeah. Dave's such a good guy. He, as you know, gave the eulogy at Eldon's funeral.
Oh, yeah.
And did a wonderful job, even though he could barely hold it together.
Sure. He did, and then this past year, we acknowledged those missing in action, which it took a lot of work again, and this is under your tenure.
Well, this is
under, pulled it off with a good team effort there.
Mike Tower did it.
Absolutely.
With Bonnie Cooper again, and they'd been planning it since 19, and it was supposed to go forward in 20, but COVID canceled our live participation at SOA at the SOAR. And the numbers by age and by COVID are dramatically reduced. We had hoped to have a bigger crowd, but it was still a very successful event.
Oh, yeah.
Very successful. And as you know, Mike Taylor, not only at the end of our SOAR, received our highest award, the Jim Butler Founders Award, but a few days later at the SFA convention that a lot of us attended, he received the SFA's highest award. The St. Philip Neri Gold Medal, which is
the gold medal,
the gold medal. So he picked up both of the Olympic gold medals within a week. I had the opportunity and the high honor of giving him his, and we kept it under wraps. There's only two people besides the board who knew about it. One was his wife, and the other was Diane Butler, Jim's widow.
Yeah.
And I asked both of them to come up to the dais to give it to him. So there's a very nice picture of Mike surrounded by his wife and Diane Butler.
It's a great photo. And then, just for the record, for our listeners, Jim Butler was a officer, recon. There's a couple of outstanding stories I'm working on now with his daughter to try to get them for the record at some point. But he ran recon at CCN. We were together there during my second tour. And then he and a few others put together the very early first version of the Special Operations Association, was 001 number.
Yeah, 001. Mike Taylor was a part of that. Larry Trimble was a part of that.
That's right. Dave Maurer.
Dave Maurer was a part of that up out of Fort Devens when they still had some troops up there. So, yeah, it was very interesting getting to know Jim's family. Attended the funeral at Arlington. They had a very nice celebration of life in Carmel before that, which we had a bunch of guys at. And then we... the SFCT helped us host a reception at the O Club for the Butler family at the internment, and then we hosted them at SOAR, where they got to meet a lot of Jim's mates and admirers.
Indeed.
Yes.
That's part of our unique history there, and it's really, I don't know, I'm biased. So we should, any other... After, I forgot your law school. So you graduate from law school, and then what happens from there? You get into litigation before you became where you're serving now.
Yeah, I was a trial lawyer for many years. And
what's your specialty?
I defended people who were sued for medical malpractice or for products liability or automobile accidents, construction cases. And about 25 years ago, some judges and lawyers asked me to start mediating cases, try to settle cases rather than fight them. And that's the mediation process, not because of me, but because of many smarter people than me, has sort of taken over from the civil jury trial of resolving civil disputes. So that 99% of cases are solved by mediation or out of court. And
you avoid all that time in court that civil cases can go for months.
It can go for years. But the biggest piece is the people themselves participate in their own resolution rather than having a jury and a judge tell them what their outcome is. And so it's a very satisfying second career for me. I'm very happy with it. And as long as I keep getting calls from lawyers and judges, and I still have my health, I'll do it.
And you're still doing it. You're working hard today. Everybody else is retired, but Doug's churning on.
I like working.
Indeed. More fun that way. So we're heading down the road here to near the end. Any reflection thoughts about your time either in SOG before and I love the story about how you served in SF, and then I forgot you even turned it down. They said, "We'll give it to you." He said, "No, fuck off," in your succinct fashion.
We still had a bit of an attitude then, didn't we?
We did.
Yes.
And yours is more a little bit more accentuated than mine.
No, I'm terrifically glad that I was able to serve with SOG. What a great bunch of guys! Very interesting people, very outside the box people, willing to do different things. But all concentrating on the same two missions, to accomplish the mission and to look to your left and look to your right and take care of your buddy.
So indeed.
It was a wonderful experience.
Indeed. Well, on that note, we'll come to a close here. And we want to again thank Jocko Willink Productions for making this SOG cast possible. And we also want to thank all the military that is protecting our country today. First responders, Border Patrol, other agencies that are serving our country. We also want to thank the men and the women who are online today and for those that have served in the past. And last but not least, we want to remember and salute the men who are not here today. We thank Jocko for that.
Amen.
Amen, Airborne. Well, Kerry, welcome to the show, and a little postscript here for SOGcast number 19, Doug Godshaw. I mean, the classic, humble soldier. What a pain in the ass to interview, I gotta tell you that, but what a great guy, and his stories.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the outsider looking into this.
Yeah, again, with the humility here, like you say, it's the hardest part about some of these conversations is these guys just, you got to pry it out of them, you know, but just more amazing stories from another amazing guy on the ground with SOG. Just really impressive stuff.
And I ran these missions with Eldon Bargewell.
Mm-hmm.
My God, and who, just for our listeners, Eldon was E4 with us at FUBI in 1968 with Doug at Mylock, which was just a complete shithole there. And they ran missions out of there.
Yeah.
And and Eldon was in for 40 years.
Wow.
He retired as a two-star, ran most of his life dedicated to spec ops, all the way through his career, started as enlisted, became an officer and a gentleman on top of it.
Yeah.
Went through the ranks and with the Delta Force, was there for years.
Uh-huh.
Started out as a squad member, became the squad leader, platoon leader, and then the commander for Delta Force for many years.
Yeah.
His two boys went through it.
Gosh. And he, you know, Doug was saying he ran 13 missions with Eldon. So, and that was just with his little time with Eldon. How many missions did Eldon run?
Oh, I know.
I mean, can you imagine?
Right. We just have to say that. And on his second tour of duty, Eldon Bargewell earned the Distinguished Service Cross.
Wow.
During a major firefight with the NVA, including him getting shot in the face.
Oh, my gosh.
And as the team was getting onto the helicopter, he was the last man on and stood there with his RPD firing at the enemy to make sure the team could get on and get extracted.
Now, we contrast that with the other story that we heard about the officer being the first one off the
Major,
off the helo.
Major Moore.
Yeah. Major Moore being the first one off the helo, you know, RTB, right?
Yes.
And that's the contrast, especially from a troop, seeing the leader who is the first one on the bird out and the first one stepping off versus the last guy putting down cover fire to make sure the team is safe and secure on the bird and getting out of there.
Yeah, and the other thing, in talking to Doug, I've heard these different stories at different times, but never together.
Yeah.
And so he's savvy enough. Here I am. He gets kicked out of Special Forces training, but I still want to go to NOM. He gets to NOM. He want to become SF? Sure.
Yeah.
And he comes in, and Mr. Modesty, who knows how many missions, because knowing him, he never wrote anything down.
Yeah.
He survived August 23rd. Again, I think the critical point was, thank God he was drunk.
Yeah.
Because he and John Peters were both there. They both exited and went their separate ways.
Mm-hmm.
Had they gone out like Bill Brick, because they had machine gunners set up, that just as people came out, like unfortunately, Brick and 15 others, they were just gunned down or killed in their beds with the satchel charges.
Oh, God, that's such a tragic day and event in SOG history. And every time we hear about it from one of these gentlemen, it just... I can't imagine. I can't imagine that kind of, having the one place that's semi-secure, that you can actually have a drink and hang out and hang with your buddies, and that being that place, that haven being violated and overrun, it's just, it's gut-wrenching a little bit. But yeah, Doug, did what he thought was right in the moment.
He did. He survived it.
Survived.
Right. And of course, we talked about John Walton again a little bit. Mm-hmm. On that night, he and Rod Podlaski were in a hooch.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they've been drinking enough, but they hear the explosions and they go, we got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And so they're debating, trying to put their shoes on.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get out the door. And fortunately, they didn't. While they're doing a debate, an NVA tried to open up the door, but the door had an extra strong spring on it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you open the door, it slams shut really hard. Mm-hmm. Well, the NVA opened the door, went to throw the satchel charge in. The door closed, the satchel charge landed, and blew away the steps.
Gosh.
So when John had his shoes, he waited for Podlaski to get his act together.
Mm-hmm.
So Polish Pride and him go running out the door. There's no steps.
Mm-hmm.
They both fell down as the machine gunner opened up.
Oh, my God.
And the machine gunner was shooting where he anticipated they would be coming down the steps. But instead, they fell, and they fell beneath the fire from the machine gun, from the enemy fire.
Because of that satchel charge blowing away the steps. Wow.
Yeah, that's John Walton.
There was a... That's an...
And Rod Podlaski.
Incredible. Incredible. There was one thing I thought I caught when Doug was talking about that night, and I wanted to run it past you and make sure I got it correct. He said that the NVA had planted machine guns in the Indige living quarters. Did I hear that correctly?
That's what he said.
As almost a psyops type of attack to maybe try to make the Americans suspicious of the Indige. Does that sound right?
I think it was with dare to kill the Indige.
I see.
Yeah.
Got it.
And whether it got into the hooch or not, we know, as he said, I forgot the number of Indige that we had lost that night or were wounded.
I don't even know if he could recall either.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that was recorded in any way, but just again, just a massive loss and a tragic, tragic event in SOG history.
Yeah. And, had not Larry Trimble been up on the mountain, there would have been much higher casualties.
He was taking out those mortar positions, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And just the night, I was just glad I was at FUBA. That was a good one to miss.
Yeah, gosh. I can't imagine.
So getting back to Doug, Eldon recalled him and said, come on, go to the reunion.
Mm-hmm.
He showed up and said, hey, we need somebody for the board of directors. And he was on the board for at least two tours of duty, and then he just ran for president, and he's president for the next 3 years.
Fantastic.
And they pulled off these events with the help of Mike Taylor and their board of directors just to keep that going,
Yeah.
So it's amazing service to our guys.
And thank goodness for that reunion and that organization bringing you gentlemen together and giving us the opportunity to hang with these guys.
Indeed.
Incredible.
Well, on that note, we'll close for tonight. And again, as always, we thank Jocko Willink Productions for making all this happen. Thank him for sending you down here for these last recordings.
Yes, sir.
And we look forward to doing SOGcast number 20 sometime in the near future.
In the meantime, as always, we thank all of our service members, the first responders, the Border Patrol that help our country, and of course the men and women who could not be here today. And we sign off on that final salute to all of our MIAs, of which there are 1,584 today in Southeast Asia from the Vietnam War, and of which we have 50 Green Berets from the Sikh War. So we'll end on that final salute, airborne.
All the way.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.